They have to my left a very distinguished panel of scientists. The four speakers of early this morning have joined two other distinguished scientists from the Antarctic community. And it will be my pleasure to introduce first Dr. Anders Carlqvist. He is Director General of the Swedish Polar Research Organization and has been in his position as a manager for the last 25 years. He has a background in mathematics and physics, and he's professor in system analysis from the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm. He has also served as chairman for COMNAP and was a member of the review group for the restructuring of SCAR. I will give now the opportunity of Dr. Carlqvist to 2 or 3 minutes to present your view about what we were talking about.
Thank you for being part of this discussion today. We got some instructions beforehand, namely a paper showing different ideas about the relation between science and policy making that we could take on in this discussion. And this one aspect that I would like to add to this list, which I think is not explicitly mentioned, but has played a tremendously important role, as far as I can see, during the 25 years and probably in the 50 years perspective we are talking today. And that is the relation between science and technology. I think technology development in this period has made a tremendous impact on science. And this is a two-way street in the sense that, on one hand, scientists and science has been a challenge to technical development of various sorts, but also that technology has developed in a way that has affected the way we do science, not only the methods of science, but also the problems that we are posing. And these are the kind of technologies which are not necessarily Antarctic to start with, but generic in a sense. And of course, in this 50 years perspective, it's a fantastic development of things which we couldn't dream of and which we take for granted today in terms of generic technology like satellites, computer, internet, all that sort of things. And I think this has to be noted and makes us maybe a little bit cautious of what to speculate about the next 50 years to come. And of course, global science today, in the way we understand it, would not be possible without, for example, the satellites and the information capability of computers and so forth. So that would be my first comment to this discussion about the relation between global science and Antarctica.
Yeah, thank you, Anders, and it's very timely because it's, overseas all the talks of this morning. Everyone needed technology for doing research, and technology has allowed many, many discoveries and research improvements we've seen in the last years. And to the left end of the panel is Professor Jørn Tide for the University of Copenhagen. He is of German origin, but he has worked in countries like Denmark, Norway, and the US for many years before settling down in Germany. As a paleoceanographer, he learned to sail the world oceans to understand the history of their shape, waters, and life. In the early 80s, he became interested in the Arctic Ocean, and after accepting the appointment as director of the German AVI, Alfred Wegener Institute, also in the Southern Oceans and Antarctica. He served as SCAR president between 2002 and 2006 and succeeded not only to make this organization fit for the IPY, but to put its focus again in excellence in Antarctic research. Presently, he's involved in the Aurora Borealis project, which aims to construct the most powerful research icebreaker which ever existed. Please.
Thanks very much. I would like to take the opportunity in this session, Antarctica's role in global science, to make 3 points. One is, I think we had 4 very elegant scientific presentations, and they sounded as if all problems were solved. But you have to realize that There are three major segments of the Earth's crust which are completely unknown. This is the deep Arctic Ocean, this is the Earth's crust under the Greenland ice sheet, and this is basically the Earth's crust under the Antarctic ice sheet, and it's completely unknown hydrologic regime. So I think there's major challenges in terms of scientific problems waiting for us. Now, are we probably equipped to do that? I mean, we saw many beautiful pictures of stations and of traverses and so on. And I think much progress has been achieved over the past decades, in particular during the International Polar Year. But are we really using this infrastructure properly? And we have seen this influx of new members to the Antarctic Treaty and to SCAR, and every nation who joined these organizations had to establish their own station. There are many stations in Antarctica which have capacities which can accept many, many more scientists. And I think, and we have actually had quite a bit of discussions in SCAR to argue against an unnecessary large number of new stations. I know this is maybe in conflict with the national desires, but still I think this should be discussed and debated together with COMNAP. At sea, we are even in a worse position. The first generation of dedicated polar research vessels was the Norwegian Fram and the Maud, and then the German Gauss at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And then there was a lapse of 80 years or so until the next generation of dedicated polar research vessels was built. And so these are Akademik Fedorov and Polarstern and Odin and Healy and so on. But they are starting to be outdated. And I think we have to think about how this is supposed to go on in the future. And you have to realize that on the southern hemisphere, there's a deficit of research vessels. Most of the data are summer data we have, and there's not many ships, almost no ship, which really can go into the deep southern ocean during the winter time. And so I think there are crucial data missing. Now, why does it happen? And, I think this is a little bit our own fault. I mean, we have quite a fragmented nature of our research organization. There's the Antarctic Treaty System as the umbrella of over. Then there's SCAR, there's COMNAP, there's CAMELA, and so on. Why do these organizations have to be separate? I mean, how can you drive science forward and not be very closely linked to the logistics? And I think it would be a good idea if we use this 50th anniversary of the Antarctic Treaty System to see what kind of changes we could generate. For example, one of the ideas which could be entertained, I mean, the Antarctic Treaty System has its office now in Buenos Aires, and I think this is pertinent because Antarctica and the Southern Ocean, the Southern Hemisphere problem, and these organizations should be there. Why don't we move the SCAR office and the COMNAP office and the CAMELA office into the same building as the Antarctic Treaty System? That all these synergies between the scientific organizations and the political organization could go together. Cornelia Lüdecke pointed out with the illustration of the first polar year how important these bipolar aspects are. SCAR has learned to talk with IASC, and I think this is an interesting future perspective. And finally, I hope that all these panel debates at the occasion of this 50th anniversary should lead to a situation where we, in the ensuing formal later meetings of the Antarctic Treaty System and of SCAR and of the other, we really should consider these problems and see how we can improve the system and how progress can be achieved.
Thank you, Jörn. I think you raise several very interesting issues. And during this afternoon, the relationship between SCAR, COMNAP, and science logistics and so on will be discussed deeply. But I want to recall one point about the need of data. Antarctica is the less known continent, and we have the shortest record in many, many fields, for example, meteorology. And although satellites now are providing a big deal of data, they need ground truth to be certain. We have very recently and known that some data from satellites are not as accurate as we think it was or we need. So my first question, and then we'll open to the audience, please, for question is, what do you think, or to anyone in the panel, are the challenges for future science regarding this lack of homogeneous distribution of data in Antarctica? Yeah.
Data acquisition will be one key issue for the future. And of course, one reason for that is if we again think about the relation between global science and Antarctic science, that the global perspective is based so much today on modeling and simulation. And we do have the capacity to data model things which we were dreaming of in the 1960s. And this modeling will all the time need more and more accurate data. So data collection will be one of the cornerstones, I think, for the future. That also maybe will change the relation between Antarctic science and global science, in the sense that Antarctica will, at least by a group of scientists, be only regarded as one factor, one special part in a bigger pattern. And just to remind you about Olaf Urheim's comment yesterday, I think was an interesting one, when he said, will we see more or fewer scientists in Antarctica in the future? I think it's a possible scenario that we will see more science and less scientists on the ground.
I guess I'd like to comment that I think it's more important to actually think about what kind of targeted data we need than to be concerned about coverage or, you know, the spatial distribution and all of that. I think we don't spend enough time actually thinking about where, if we can only have a certain amount of money to do this science, you know, where is the best place to do certain things? What are the best things to measure? When you think back on how lucky we are, for example, that the Halley Station happened to be, you know, pretty close to the ideal place to be in to look at the ozone hole, we could have cleverly planned where we could have started making really detailed sea ice measurements to look at the sorts of things that we now see in sea ice changes in Antarctica. Maybe we should be thinking more about the future of that kind of thing. If you have some idea what's going to happen, where would be the best place? Not just let's do it everywhere, which is always too hard and too expensive, frankly.
And in this way, we have a strong tie with the Antarctic Treaty, because you say about Halley, this is true, but you also have Belgrano and Neumayer, nearby station, that are there because the Antarctic Treaty allow every country to set up their own research project for getting more data or for comparing the data from one station to the other station.
Can I make one other point about observations? The something that hasn't come up so much today is that the climate models we use now to make projections about future change vary widely in how they reproduce some aspects of the climate system. So in relation to the topic of my talk today, the way they reproduce the overturning circulation in both hemispheres and the changes in that circulation with time vary over a wide range in the different models. So one role in the observations is keeping those models on track. It's absolutely critical as a way to judge what sort of confidence we should have in the projections of those models, and that is the only information we have, really, about what our future holds. So that's another important role to for observations. And because in many aspects the poles respond first, the need for polar observations is particularly acute.
We mean Antarctic science for a source of early warning and advice. There was a question there, please.
Yeah, following up on Susan Solomon's point there, I'm interested in the sort of an epistemological question. Now, the first polar year was dominated completely by the idea that you could do synoptic observations and then somehow, looking at patterns, arrive at laws of nature. That was inductivism. During the second polar year, you had Chapman and Appleton and others, Birkner's idea about the polar front. Hypotheses came into the picture. So there was a combination both of inductivism and hypothesis-driven research. To some extent today, and it's not only in relationship to climatology and polar research, but in other fields also, biotechnology. There's debates going on where some people are saying we have a new kind of inductivism, a data-driven, technology-driven research where hypotheses are sort of, there are not enough of them around because people look at data, then they simulate, and they look at use algorithms, statistical methods, and then find patterns, and then get an idea, okay. I was just wondering in the panel, is there any kind of debate about this, and what's your view on this proliferation of data? Because, I mean, it's one thing to target data observations, but also shouldn't there be connections to the hypotheses?
Well, I guess, you know, you're right, and I would say that one of the things that can be dangerous, actually, are some of the ways in which data filling and data extrapolation are being used without, I think, sufficient discussion of the underlying physics and the underlying true uncertainties is really dangerous. So I think it's a synthesis of both things, really. I would fully agree that whenever you target any measurement, you know, you've got to have a physically based picture of why you want to do it in that particular location. So I guess that's what you're calling the hypothesis-driven way of thinking about it. I would go along with that point of view that you're going to base your choices on physics and not on whatever falls out of your neural network or whatever method you're using to assimilate a large body of data, if that's what you're getting at. I think that's a very interesting way of looking at it.
Professor Strauss.
Yes, of course, there's no guarantee that the scientific method will allow you to understand all possible phenomena, right? It's just a method that's worked particularly well in the past. And, you know, at the present time, we have a really critical problem, which is the verification of climate models, right? The whole issue of climate change hinges on what's going to happen 200 years from now based on the current situation and the extrapolation of anthropomorphic CO2. And, you know, verifying those models in a way that is believable to everyone, I think, is almost the most important thing. And you know, perhaps you have to actually understand them to verify them, but it could be done entirely on a practical basis where you make a prediction and then go out and see whether that prediction holds.
I think, I mean, there's been a major change of attitude in the mode of seeking and giving advice on Antarctic research, and I hope that the president of SCAR, Chuck Kennicott, will allude to that later in the course of the day. I mean, in the moment, SCAR has a few focused strategic programs where most of the scientific perspectives are collected under it, and I think they are really debating intensively in SCAR where measurements have to be taken and how this is done. And I think this is different than a few years ago. Now, on the other hand, I mentioned these many stations. I mean, go to King George Island. There are, I think, 20 stations from 20 nations or something like that. I've been there in 1966, and I visited all the stations, and I tried to get a list of the instruments which are deployed on King George Island. It was impossible. I hope this will change under the present regime of COMNAP. I think there has to be much more openness between in this interchange that you can really have these strategic discussions where to take which measurements.
I would like to come back on the potential of the ice core in giving information on the past climate. And we are far to harvest all the informations on the past climate. And currently, there is several programs which are deployed in West Antarctica for studying the high-resolution record, maybe back to 100,000 years. In Greenland, there is a NAME program, which is which deal to see or to discover if the last interglacial was recorded in the Greenland, and to know if the Greenland has disappeared 100,000 years ago. So the high-resolution record may help to understand the dynamic of the climate. I'm not talking about meteorology, but if we are making some perspective, long-term perspective, we have to take into account other parameters. Let's say the mode of the climate, or the volcanisms, or the solar activity. So those are uncertainties which are important to estimate, and the ice could bring some issue.
We have two questions. And
I think that the main challenge still will be to assess the value of large-scale simulation models to give a sort of comprehensive, holistic build of picture of global change. And in spite of the fact that we are making quite progress on specific issues, understanding the chemistry and the physics, we will still be have a problem to put it together in the complexity of the whole system, where you have things like cloud formation or cloud distribution as a key factor, which is probably one of the weak links in the overall models, which are the things that will be on the table to be related to the decision-making and the policy of climate in the future. So simulation will be one of the big issues, I think, for future studies in this area.
Yeah, we have a question there.
Yeah. Jim Barnes from the Antarctic Coalition. One of the things that has perplexed me for a long time, and I've been involved in this Antarctic stuff for more than 30 years, is why we don't seem to be able to translate to the public and to decision makers, e.g. politicians, all the wonderful science that's coming out of Antarctica. So just take the climate change stuff. Now, we have a big conference starting soon. A couple of months ago, I started asking around, well, how is SCAR going to be involved in the Copenhagen summit? And the answer seemed to be, well, they're not. They are now invited. Colin is going to come to Copenhagen as part of the NGO big tent, so to speak, and is going to present the latest paper. But you've got this fantastic science on all kinds of levels, and I think you really need to ask yourselves how you can get it more into the minds, the heads, the brains of decision makers, and inform the public about it so they can, in a sense, put pressure on the governments to act on the basis of your science.
Well, I have a short comment on that. Answer partially, not completely, your question or observation. You are completely right. One part is scientists are formed to think in a certain way, which is not very compatible to reaching the general public sometimes. But there are specialized people that make the bridge between pure science and public. But the other comment is about media make their own priorities. They make their own agenda. And sometimes science is not in the high priority for media. So I don't know, what do you think about this?
Yeah, can I comment on this question? Because I've had, as you know, a fair amount of personal experience in it, both with Montreal and with Kyoto. I think it's fundamental that we step back and ask ourselves what we think our role actually is. And I would argue that our role certainly is in doing science. Our role is also in making the science known to the public. I tried to emphasize in my talk how important I believe that has been for ozone and certainly continues to be for the climate issue. But I think it's imperative that we stop short of actively campaigning one way or the other in any political forum. So I think that it's fundamental that we impart our information to the public wherever we can, as much time as we can spend on it, that's great. But, you know, what's happening in Copenhagen, you know, the good news, I suppose, is that there's a broad public understanding and a broad understanding among policy people of what the situation is. So I would say that SCAR's presence in Copenhagen really is not necessary, because what they're going to be discussing in Copenhagen is not going to require that kind of help. They know what they need to know. So, you know, we should let them get on with it, and we should also clearly delineate our role rather than trying to mix the roles. That's my view.
Professor Rintoul, first.
I guess another perspective on this, as I was preparing for this meeting, I started thinking a bit more about the science-policy interface. It's something that we struggle a bit with in all of the context of our work. The Antarctic example is a case where science has always been integral, in the sense that science sort of gave you the invitation to the Antarctic dance. You know, it was the currency of Antarctic affairs to some extent, in the way the treaty system is set up. But I'm not so sure that and so the two are important to each other. The science that gets done, it gets done in part because of the policy imperatives. But I'm not sure that the two are really as deeply engaged as they could be and as they need to be, as we start moving from Antarctica as a wilderness that's exciting to understand and that's inspirational to a place to make discovery, to a situation where what's happening there is critical to many of the challenges that we face as a society. And so I'd be interested if this conference could tease out that, how to make that interface between science and policy work more effectively. It may be an example where the Antarctic Treaty has been experienced, has been provided some leadership in governance of international spaces that's provided lessons for aspects outside Antarctica. Perhaps the Antarctic community can do the same thing with the science policy interface.
We have two or three questions, and I know some panelists asked me, but the floor, but I'd like to Professor Jacobson. Yes, she asked first for the floor. All the. I'm sorry, I can't.
There's a microphone up at the back.
Yeah, I know Olaf has one, and there is another lady. And yeah, okay, we'll do that. First, the young lady there, and then Dr. Jacobson. I am certain she asked the floor, and then in the privileged place. I'm sorry, Olaf. Yeah, wow. Please.
I guess my question actually feeds or was addressed exactly to this last comment that was made, and regarding this science policy interface. And I think it would be nice to expand maybe a little bit more on that, because my question kind of began thinking back from yesterday's discussions about, well, we don't really have a method for assessing good science in terms of new claimants coming onto to the Antarctic Treaty System. And as of late, I was hoping I can actually submit this anonymously, but there's been a lot of discussion in the media about the manipulation, perhaps, of some data on climate change science. And I guess my question comes about, is this, you know, is this, and this is, and it's science, you know, from the, you know, from prestigious institutions. And so I'm wondering if this is just an instance, allegations against certain researchers. Is it a condition of perhaps scientists not being able to remove themselves from the policy interface and therefore being subject to forced to be put their research in a direct their research in a certain area or direction regarding funding? Or is this, you know, is it a few people, or is it symptomatic of this larger, you know, the politics of science that, Susan, you tried to, you know, you state that there is the distinction is important, but I find that there's just a politics inherently built into science, and this is one of those instances. And
well, you're entitled to your opinion, but frankly, I don't think that this forum would benefit by our starting to speculate on the questions that you're
I'm not speculating myself, I'm sorry, and I don't mean to speculate, and I'm not making judgments. I'm just, there's media discussion, and this is not my personal opinion, I've just been my brother's been asking me questions because he knows I'm at this conference, and people are just interested.
Well, so, people actually, one of the challenges, in my opinion, of the 21st century is that people have to learn to take what they read on the internet with a grain of salt. It's happening throughout our society. It's the price we're paying for an interconnected society. And it's hard. It's hard. But I think that there will never be an oracle that you can go to and say, you know, please tell me what the truth is about this or that rumor on the internet. I just don't think it benefits us to carry this on.
Yeah, but let's hear all the question, and then Jörn is asking me to. So, no, don't give up the microphone, Olaf. Please, we go to you after Professor Jacobson.
Thank you. And thank you all for excellent presentation and very stimulating discussion. I have two main questions. One is also on the connection between science and policy and law. And here I am very interested, and I've been for quite some time in the role of modeling, science modeling and the results, because I've understood that, as someone here said, that data modeling needs correct data. So since policymakers and lawyers in the end will have to rely on the result from these models, it is absolutely crucial that the data are correct. And I wonder, I like your view as scientist, how you deal with this, how you, for example, when it comes to the Southern Ocean, how do you deal with this data that to ensure that you put correct data in? Of course, I understand it's the aim of any scientist to put correct data in, but since a minor difference can give really, really great results, different results in the end, this is really crucial for us when we want to take decision on a policy level. This has nothing to do with discrediting science or anything. It just has to do that we will need something to make the right decisions in the end. So that is one thing. The other thing is what Anders Carlqvist alluded to, it's really, and what, a little bit to pick up the question from the discussion from yesterday, is really where the science takes place. And I found it quite interesting that, Anders, you indicated that we might see less scientists but more science in Antarctica in the future. And I don't know if you talk about that in relative terms or not, because yesterday we heard a view that we would need more scientists, not only science but also more scientists in Antarctica. And I'd like to hear your view about that. Now, these were my two questions. I have one comment, and it might be a misunderstanding when you read the Antarctic Treaty in relation to what is required to become a consultative party. The Antarctic Treaty does not say good science. The Antarctic Treaty says substantial scientific research. This is a difference. And the reason for that is, of course, that the background to this provision is the need to be present in Antarctica, to have a presence in Antarctica so as to know the continent. And 50, 60 years ago, those who wrote the treaty did not foresee that we would have satellites and you didn't even need to go down there. So this is the reason for that particular formulation. Thank you.
Thank you. I will suggest to listen to the question Professor Olaf Orhen has, and then we try to answer, because something from Professor Jacobson is related to the previous person, and we can answer all on the whole packet.
I just wanted to clarify to Jim Barnes and anybody else who don't read the Times every day that SCAR yesterday put out in the press conference, which was very well attended, a new more than 500-page book on climate change in the Antarctic. And every person going to the COP15 conference is actually getting a copy of this. And the results from that, which has a 10-page summary, is part of that is actually on the front page of Times today and all sorts of other news media. So SCAR is actually doing what Jim Barnes asked about, And as I'm sure somebody else could have answered even better if they'd been here.
Yeah, thank you, Olaf, for this clarification. And regarding the role of SCA, which was raised here a few minutes, I will leave Professor Chuck Kennicott, present president of SCA, who will be a speaker in the afternoon, to clarify this. And we may concentrate the last 5 minutes of this panel to answer the question regarding science. And I think we have two main concerns raised here about credibility of data and the results and just how the politician or the decision-making person can take this or not. And the other was about the independence or how we select the issues can or topics that we prefer or deserve more money or attention for research. I think everyone has something to say about this. Briefly so we can talk.
First of all, I'd like to say that I agree completely with Susan's position when it comes to the relation between science and politics. Secondly, about the data uncertainties or lack of data and quality of data, I think that is part of the problem, but it's not the only thing. When you talk about this simulation modeling, there are structural uncertainties, there are all sorts of uncertainties involved, and it's a very difficult job really for science to convey that sort of message to the policymakers in the right way. So that is a problem we are facing, uncertainties in many different dimensions. My comment on less scientists and more science in Antarctica is a bit speculative, of course, but it relates primarily to the idea of global science problems and those issues which are related to overall problems where Antarctica is just a piece of the cake, so to speak. And I think that will be a change in the sense that scientists are more interested in the topics than in the geography. And in addition to that, we will see more of technology coming in, probably more technicians going to Antarctica to serve the instruments than the scientists who can be sit back at home watching their computers.
About the data?
Oh, any part of the question?
Just a comment. There is some data that we cannot discuss in the evidence of the rising CO2. So I guess this is a global indicator, and the observation for the present as well as the observation of the ice give you some evidence that you have to take into account.
Okay. Just on the issue of data quality and uncertainty, it's clearly the case that it's imperative that scientists are as careful as they can about quantifying and stating the uncertainty of whatever results that they have. And it is true that we don't have, the data is not perfect and the models are not perfect, but we do know some things. As an example of something we know very well, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere and its rise in over the last century or more is something that we know very precisely. Something like the local pattern of rainfall resulting from that, changes in local patterns of rainfall resulting from that increase in CO2 is something we don't know very well. The fact that we don't know everything with absolute certainty, though, is not an excuse not to act, because what we do know sufficiently well is the broader scale patterns of change. I mentioned that there was a widespread in the models about how they represent this overturning circulation I talked about. All of the models that we've ever run, all show a slowing of that circulation with climate change. None of them show a change in the other direction. Exactly when that happens and by how and how rapidly does vary between the models. And so the science is uncertain in some aspects, and that does make decision-making more difficult, but it's just the reality. We deal with uncertainty in every other aspect of our lives, whether it's what the economy is going to do or something else. And so we need to face up to the fact that things will be uncertain, and our job as scientists is to quantify that uncertainty as well as we can to provide better information to inform policy, not to set it, not to play politics, but to inform the decisions that are made.
Yeah, I won't ask a young teacher, but to be maybe short as possible, because yes, we need time for the last question.
Very short. Please. I think this is almost an unfair attack if people say that the Antarctic scientists don't try to go out. I mean, after IPY, there was a huge effort in outreach to make the results of the IPY well known. And if you remember what David Boyd yesterday said about SCAR, that it wants to give independent scientific advice based on very good, high-quality science. It's no surprise that SCAR has not been automatically invited to Copenhagen. The people in Copenhagen, or the conference in Copenhagen, is in the hands of a group of people who want to achieve a specific predetermined result. And I think this... I can live with the fact that SCAR is not very prominent in Copenhagen.
And I give the floor to Professor Bergman, ask for a question.
I want to thank each of you for your thoughtful contributions. I think the whole question of science policy interaction is introduced well in this panel. Early on in your discussion, Anders suggested measurements around the world, in a sense, large scale, and Susan tempered that with suggesting that it makes sense to consider the realities of resources and balancing those decisions strategically. Perhaps part of the science policy interface is tasking the scientists to be more astute about the economic and political realities of the research that they're involved with, to make decisions that are not solely based on their science, but to recognize that those decisions are the types of science that's capable, the types of interfaces is related to other considerations. I also would note, in terms of following what Susan said about advocacy, there is a way of avoiding advocacy in the sense of merely providing advice, not championing one solution or another. In a sense, the decision makers have an enormous burden to weigh the scientific information, the political information, the cultural economic information, and then make decisions that are in the interests of the largest audience. And so in a sense, we're just contributing a piece of that puzzle. But there is an opportunity to do that with objectivity, in the sense of providing advice without making specific recommendations or advocacy.
Thank you, Paul. And we are short of time, and I'm sorry. We can stay here talking and talking, but anyone has a last comment on this?
I guess I do think we have to address this issue of how do we know if our science is good enough to help policy? And I think Steve's points were very useful, but I would also say that it's essential on a topic like this to have different kinds of measurements by different groups using different techniques and all of them characterizing their uncertainties carefully. Those are the things you ought to look for. And I think it's all the more reason why an activity like Antarctica that involves so many different nations, so many different methodologies, all of that comes together to support a scientific conclusion. So, you know, when you look at climate change, let me just say, you know, it's not just that atmospheric temperatures are rising. It's the fact that glaciers are melting. Ocean temperatures, as Steve showed, are also rising. Ice is melting worldwide. Lake and rivers are winter ice is not lasting as long. All of those things taken together give you a much stronger confidence than any one of them alone. So I think it's the coherence of the way we approach a science policy issue that's essential.
Okay, so time's up, and I have to thanks Anders and Jorn for your participation, as well as all of you. Thank you so much. And
thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.